for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show today. I'm very excited because we've got two fantastic guests. And in the first hour of the show, I am joined by Francis Hoare, who's a barrister who specializes in public law, especially election law, commercial law, and employment law. And in 2015, there was an internationally reported case because Francis, appearing against two QCs, won a petition which the High Court voided the election of Lutfi Rahman as mayor of Tower Hamlets. He couldn't stand for them for 5 years, and we know what then happened with him, but he's back again, Lutfi Rahman, so we could talk about that a bit. But you'll know Francis, I'm sure, much more, many of you, from campaigning around issues of freedom and free speech, especially. Francis Hoare, welcome today to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Good evening and good morning, everyone.
Exactly. So, Francis, just to kick off, remind us, because, you know, we're looking at a potentially a 7-year COVID inquiry and amnesia and all sorts of things going on. But what led you to be quite so vocal at the start of things when lockdowns were announced and everything? What, just take us back to that moment and what was it about what was done that got you to actually raise your head above what perhaps would be seen as a very kind of conservative career, really?
Yeah, well, I suppose the background is that I long held fairly, well, I think, a fairly mainstream liberal conservative views, which it involved believing in community, society, the state and state institutions, but also the state staying out of life as much as is possible within a good framework. So relatively mainstream views, I think. And that I think leads me to be very wary about huge scale state interventions in general. I hadn't thought a great deal about pandemics and pandemic responses until 2020. It was sort of on my radar a little bit. I was a little bit aware of it. I've got a very good friend, Lucy Eastoke, who's been very, very cool about all of this over the last 3 years, who's been integrally involved in that. And I was aware of that to a certain extent, but not in great detail. Obviously, I became more interested in it in early 2020. But what happened then just shocked me. I couldn't believe what was happening in, well, I could believe what was happening in China in January 2020. That's the kind of totalitarian way in which that regime behaves. But what was extraordinary was the speed with which it became a common approach that we could resort to medieval style measures, even more extreme, in fact, than medieval style measures, because people in the plagues were not told that they couldn't leave their house if they didn't have a plague. That the whole point was you locked infected people in at home. But these were medieval measures more broadly. They had never been even contemplated in the modern era. And they were being endorsed on a regular basis and on an increasing basis by, you know, the elites of society, by the media, and by ordinary people with very, very little reflection indeed. And this was, as we all know, it's contrary to all precedent, modern precedent. The pandemic wasn't. It wasn't any more serious than others in the 20th century, a lot less serious than Spanish flu. And that was obvious from at least February with the Diamond Princess. And that was, if you cared to look into it, that was available evidence for people who were concerned about it. And you'd think that if you were going to impose extraordinary measures, going back to a medieval way of looking at things, and disregarding obviously elementary freedoms and societal norms, you would want to look into that. The other point that I thought from the start is that this is not just about freedom, it's about societies, it's about the community. And I just immediately saw how much damage it would do to small businesses, to small communities, probably to big businesses, although we know many have, subsequently, we know many have benefited hugely from it too. And how much harm treating society like a bear, which can hibernate, and you can just put it to bed, and put everything on aspic, and it will all be okay. It will wake up in March or April or whatever. Whereas it's not. My analogy is it's like a shark. It's society and the economy needs to move constantly, or it begins to die. It begins to drop to the bottom of the ocean. To continue that analogy, and that has been proved completely right. And I have absolutely no regrets about my position from the start. And I'm just amazed, and I continue to be amazed, that so many people took the other approach with so little reflection, frankly.
And it's, yeah, thank you, that's very clear. And it is remarkable, is it not, that now in a kind of cost of living, some would say a cost of lockdown crisis, where a lot of the things that some people who were warning about, these never done before measures where we would shut down vast swathes of the economy, as you say, have an impact across society on families, on children, closing schools, imposing all sorts of restrictions, that there seems to be a disconnect when we're talking about the things currently and this legacy of these measures, these very draconian measures. It's almost as if people want to completely forget about that. And you might say, well, it's understandable that those that implemented them would rather we forgot about them. But I'm sort of saying a bit more broadly as well. Certainly, little critical discussion in the media about it, in spite of things like the lockdown files coming out, which is the, you know, Isabel Oakeshott and the Telegraph. And also, though, more generally across society, I mean, I'm not sure if you agree with that. And I wonder what your thoughts are on it.
I do agree. I think there's a collective, well, it's not a collective amnesia. I think people are all too well about what happened, aware of what happened in the last 3 years, particularly ending 2 years ago or so. But I think maybe there is a collective embarrassment that people rushed into something so extraordinary and so damaging, and people want to forget about it. People who've been severely harmed by it, and one can think of all sorts of people in that situation, those with mental health difficulties, those who've lost their jobs, those who've lost businesses that they took 20 to 30 years to build up. I know some people like that, no doubt you do too. For them, I suppose when you suffer trauma, you want to concentrate on yourself and how you recover from it rather than other things. And from the point of view of everyone in the various groups, i.e. government, parliament, the media, the medical profession, to an extent the legal profession, and so on, who have supported this, or at least not opposed it, and sometimes supported it vocally, there is a huge interest in not considering it in an open way and in a reflective way, because clearly when that is done, one might ask why it was done at the beginning and look at the evidence and consider the harms. And I think it's very difficult to see how you can look back and think that this was something that worked and was successful and was proportionate. And in fact, that word proportionate, it is a really important one. And that was the main plank of why I was so against all these measures, because we as public lawyers, proportionality is an important concept, but it's not a new one. You obviously balance harms against benefits, and you look at evidence, and you do things in a sensible, calm and rational and reflective way, rather than rushing headlong into completely new territory that you know must cause huge harm, but you say is essential because things are so desperate, notwithstanding not considering where they really are. I think for that reason, people who have encouraged this, and that means most people in positions of power and influence in society and societies across the world, certainly including Australia and Britain, obviously, with very few exceptions, Sweden is the obvious example, have everything to lose and nothing to gain from a proper open discussion and consideration and evaluation of the evidence and what happened. And that is absolutely not what is happening in the UK with the COVID inquiry.
Just before we get into that, I'm interested to hear what you think. You obviously work in an area of law where you, I'm sure, come into contact with lots of different politicians and a range of people, civil service and others. What happened, right? What, you know, because it's a difficult question, maybe, maybe not. But at the start of it, it looked like the government were going to take a certain approach. And then they did a U-turn. Some people were saying that was always the intention. But from your point of view, why do you think it was that pandemic preparedness strategy was just simply jettisoned? Something that was in there, in place, as you say, to deal with a pandemic when it comes along. And so, and then so many measures that ordinarily people would have said, well, you know, suspending free speech, suspending parliament, the rights to protest, all the things that are paramount in a free society, in our society, all these things happen. I mean, what do you think happened that led to that? Why did this happen in this way here?
Well, this is a much discussed and debated issue. And I've no doubt that there may be undercurrents of power and influence about which we're unaware. And obviously there's been a certain amount of coordination and copying of different countries, which I suppose to an extent you would expect. But I think fundamentally it was panic. And I think that comes through very strongly in the dubbed WhatsApp messages. So you're right, Chris Whitty, the UK or English, sorry, Chief Medical Officer, Patrick Vallance, who was the Chief Scientific Advisor to the government, were being very sensible and giving the kind of messaging that was always prepared for and is entirely sensible and was continued in Sweden, which was don't panic. Remember that this is a virus that does discriminate, as unlike what was said later. If you are very old and very ill, then you need to be really concerned about it. But if you're not, you don't. And obviously, you need to be very concerned about visiting your relatives who might be very old or very sick, or who have a particular problem with risk from the virus. And that's exactly the kind of sensible adult messaging and awareness campaigns that you need in things like this. And they were also planning, not particularly adequately, because although the pandemic plans were good, the lack of preparedness in terms of equipment and preparation in hospitals was less good, considerably less good. But that was overtaken by, firstly, there was the extraordinary Chinese reaction, which actually, if you look at the evidence, is not unplanned for, and is the kind of reaction that the Chinese Communist Party have adopted to an extent from the Chinese past. And Michael Senger has written about this. That is, that was completely contrary to everything we have done, and to good quality evidence by people like Henderson, who's a great pandemic expert who died shortly before this, who decried the use of lockdowns or similar things. So there was that happening. Then there was WHO, heavily influenced by China. Tedros, who is a communist, who is being accused, Dr. Tedros, who's head of the WHO, who is accused of genocide. People have made that accusation publicly because of his behavior as dictator of, or as part of the government of Ethiopia, and somebody who has very close, very unhealthy ties with China. And others have very unhealthy ties with China and the WHO. They had huge influence. That had influence on governments. And then there was a media campaign and a social media campaign. And social media, I think, has been a huge problem in this, as well as a bit of a solution, because obviously it allows people like us to voice dissent. But when we're allowed to, of course, that's a different matter. But social media at the beginning, there was a huge campaign. And in fact, Michael Senger and others have done an analysis of it, that there were thousands and thousands of accounts that were blocked by Twitter because they were Chinese media-controlled blocks. And they were putting messages like people falling over flat on their face in the street, something that never happened and never did really happen with this virus. And misinformation like that to cause a huge scare campaign, a huge campaign of fear, which had a massive influence on the media, which in turn had an influence on the unions, which in turn had an influence on other organs of the state, which in turn caused the governments in across the world to change their strategy and their plans and to panic. And that's what they did.
They did indeed. They certainly did that. And with the campaign of fear and nudge and the behavioral insights team, psychological warfare effectively is what happened. We're going to go to a break because you've set the landscape there and it's horrible remembering it all. I also go through a bit of kind of denial. Did it really happen? And of course, we know it absolutely did happen and it was shocking and terrible and very damaging. And we have to deal with that to make sure never again. When we come back, we'll be talking about the so-called COVID inquiry and many other things, yeah. Free speech, the rights to protest.
Yeah.
I'm Alan Miller. We're with Francis Hoare, and we'll see you just after this break. See you soon.
George Eliason on TNT Radio.
Now, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine said that Russia fired 81 missiles, including Kinzhals, at infrastructure-related facilities in Ukraine. Now, there's also an assumption that they made a retaliatory strike on the shadow general staff of NATO in Ukraine. Now, this is unverified rumor, but if it's true, the NATO officers who control the armed forces of Ukraine directly are no longer. How much credence would I give this report? At absolute best, 20%. There is no way anyone can or will verify this. What's interesting, though, is that Ukraine, in the aftermath of this attack, basically shut down social media from mentioning the attack at all. They're keeping it quiet. Now, Ukraine said that they shot down most of the missiles, and it may be why they also shut down social media, because it was started to buzz with the amount of hits in a lot of different areas that Ukraine was actually reeling from.
George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. The conversation continues.
I don't believe it, and I think that's a terrible position that I am in, that I don't trust my government.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. I'm Alan Miller, and we were just painting the backdrop. Francis Hoare was talking about what led up to one of the most horrific situations we faced in the 20th century across the world, and some of the damaging consequences we're still dealing with now. Francis, you know, you painted a picture there that talked about a number of different things. One of the key areas that from the get-go, and if it was that they panicked, and I understand that, and I share sympathy with some of that, this I also think it was a lack of principle as well, where kind of a lack of strength is sort of like they became weak authoritarians very quickly, right? Because in that panic, also in that sense that something must be done and we must be seen to be doing something, all sorts of measures allegedly now being said they were just guidance, but we know that from the police stopping people sitting down in the park on their own to sitting next to someone with a space on them on a bench, closing kids' playgrounds, following people around. And then alongside that, just some of the impositions, attacks on free speech, the people who are asking questions about policy decisions and what that really meant for us. And you've written a lot about the free speech side of things, but we kind of had a situation where people didn't really know what was going on legally, right? The police didn't know. There was all these things that people couldn't really tell the difference between guidance and law. I mean, what was going on?
Okay, so I want to go back to your excellent phrase, weak authoritarians. I think that's a really good phrase because it encapsulates what went on. And I think you look at some of the figures in this, they are insipid. They have no principle. They do things according to what is popular. Think, for example, Matt Hancock, a classic example of that. The lack of principle in our political class. This is really shown. the lack of experience of the outside world, and the lack of real understanding or any solid political philosophical background to their beliefs. I question whether Hancock really believes in anything, and he's right. So typical of the of that class. I think that's a real problem. And when you say weak authoritarianism, that's exactly it. Because in fact, it requires strength, it requires principle, it requires courage to stand up against those who want to lock people down. That sounds paradoxical, and perhaps it is, but it's also true. And I think that that's exactly what. As I have to say, you look back, you think, what would somebody like Margaret Thatcher have done? Margaret Thatcher would have been on top of the detail. I know that she's a very Marmite figure, if Marmite sold in Australia, a very lover or hater in a way. But I think what you can't deny is you've got somebody who knew really in great depth about policy decisions and policy across the board, who was absolutely on top of her brief. Cabinet ministers who went to see her said that they needed to know everything about their brief because she would know more about it than they did. That's the kind of person that you needed in this. You needed somebody who first of all, who knew and understood the issues and was prepared to prepared to learn about them and understand them. And that's the kind of from a standing start, potentially, although she had a scientific background, which would have helped too. And secondly, somebody who had the toughness to stand against popular but flawed ideas and a panic, and somebody who wasn't going to panic. And unfortunately, Boris Johnson was one of the worst people because he's somebody who's so desperate to be popular, although it goes against every instinct. You can imagine that him as a journalist railing against the lockdown, no doubt he would have done. Perhaps even as leader of the opposition, he would have done. Perhaps even that would have been better if he had been, for the debate about this subject. But just fell to that panic because he was weak and because he didn't have that philosophical background, or perhaps he did to an extent, and because he was extremely lazy. And that's a terrible, toxic combination. So that in terms of weak authoritarianism. In terms of the legal point, there was actually the New Zealand Court of Appeal, or possibly Supreme Court, I can't remember which, and found that the first few days of their semi-lockdown were illegal because the police were acting according to guidance that wasn't set out in law. And so you had several days of some of the most draconian impositions in the world in New Zealand, which were all unlawful. The Spanish Supreme Court, I think, decided something quite similar in either 2020 or 2021. And yes, police, and I think there's a very unfortunate tendency, particularly in Australia, much worse than in the UK, of police officers taking powers to their heads and letting the power that they had go to their heads. And that was absolutely appalling. It was appalling the way they behaved and completely nonsensical. The bans about people going outside into the fresh air where they can get their vitamin D, where they can be healthy, where they can do sports in the open air. I mean, whatever you think about the efficacy and legality even of measures about restricting contact in public places inside, there was absolutely no evidential basis, quite the reverse, for the restrictions of people outside. And it was bizarre and appalling to see police officers shouting and going around with loudspeakers telling teenagers not to sunbathe in what counts in England for warm weather in April in 2020, which was a real example, or having drones over national parks like the Peak District, and police officers using their favourite Twitter accounts to perpetuate this very political campaign. And that's another point about the police. The police became extremely politicised. They yes, of course, the police have to enforce the law, even if it's bad law. But they, what they don't need to do, and they shouldn't do, is put forward messaging which is highly political and highly controversial. And many people think, including us, no doubt, very, very wrong. They got totally involved in a very political campaign, and that's a really serious problem with a force that has an absolute duty of neutrality and proportionality. And again, to go back to that word, to enforce the law proportionately and fairly.
Yeah, I want to come back to that, but my thinking was that in places like Spain and Italy, where we'd seen this a kind of weaker state historically in the relationship, where you'd had, draconian rulers, you had dictatorships, and they had different rules on the continent in Europe. And you could see that locking people away for 3 months in their apartment and people not being able to go more than 100 yards from somewhere for a long periods of time, and things like the Guardia Civil roaming, those things were really, really enforced in an even more authoritative way in parts of Europe. And Dan Andrews and Victoria, and we saw some of those attacks on citizens. At one point, it looked like Planet of the Apes, like police officers on a horseback charging citizens and attacking them to sort of allegedly keep us safe. I think in a way as well, in Australia, kind of the relationship of the state and the policing and the different areas, it's sort of like a mixture of between the America and Britain in terms of the state and different areas, and but people sort of, some of the rulers just went out of control there. Although I've got to say a big shout out to everyone in Australia who inspired us, who was challenging and had the courage to do that, as well as across the world, because in many places it was even more difficult, much more difficult in some places than it was certainly in Britain. But I think the question I've got for you, Francis, from someone who's a lover of the law, and what does all that mean moving forwards? I mean, you know, and the role of the police, because we saw, as you say, the police were used, they were instrumentalized politically. So we saw from the Twitter files that there was an active political campaign to engage the police to enforce these things and to get the public doing them, right? So that was a particular approach and strategy. So if you go to different regional police heads and borough commanders, all get this instruction. That's a direct order. What does this mean for us into making sure things like that don't happen again? Just thoughts on that from the point of view of law and Britain.
Yeah, Alan, you said I'm a lover of the law. It's a bit of a strange concept because it's a bit of a to love something so inchoate. But what I have always felt very strongly about and believed in strongly is the common law traditions that we share with Australia and United States, Canada, New Zealand, etc., Israel, and many other countries. And the common law, the beauty of the common law is it develops according to human society, and it's a very Burkean way of looking at things. It's an organic system, not a mechanical system like the Napoleonic Code. And cases develop and the judges develop the law and develop legal principles according to the reality on the ground, the real facts. And that strikes through throughout the common law. So that, I think, is really important. It's also part of that is the facts. And this goes back very many centuries in English history to the fact that there is equality before the law and the state is limited. And obviously the limitations on the state have grown throughout the centuries, and famous fits and starts, including in 1689, for example, if we want to go back historically. So that's important, because that is absolutely an important belief of mine. But so I'm less surprised, I agree, about Spain, Italy and France, which all have had fascist governments, France not excepted with Vichy. And they had curfews, and they have had curfews in the past, and that is not something that is unusual for them. But it was very shocking to see Australia and New Zealand behave as they did. Us too, but to a lesser extent. And yes, I agree. I had the same reaction when I saw those Planet of the Apes type things. So, but the problem you identified at the end there is police and being encouraged by, again, they were wholly politicized, the police force. Police forces around Britain, around the world, and they were enforcing this state measure, which is in a way that you expect the police to do what they're told by governments in autocratic systems, in a way that you expect them to behave in China or Russia. And that's not how they should behave in a free and democratic society. There needs to be much more distance between the police and politicians. That's certainly true. Police need to have more integrity. They need to question things more. They need to stop enforcing very political campaigns. For example, the way that they do over woke ideology, for example, interviewing people and giving them records for non-hate, non-crime hate incidents if they say that anything that's remotely controversial on trans issues, for example. These are real examples. That, yes, the police force have become very, very political, very close to sort of political organs and very close to quite controversial organizations that don't necessarily speak for everyone, but they certainly
can I just ask you sorry to jump in, but I mean, so people, you know, some people that were challenging things, they'll say, well, you know, they use that term common law, they'll say we'll assert our rights under common law and we'll just challenge things. And then I suppose the question is, who are the police meant to serve? And how does that work, right? Because there's a big discussion about that, about the role of the police and what, you know, if the government of the moment says that we've got this terrible threat. And just talk through that bit. It's two different things and they're quite big questions, but people often say we're going to assert our common right law and we're just not going to do any of these things, right? Is that actually, what is that? What is your view of that? And then secondly, who are the police serving and what is their actual role, just if you can define it?
Well, so first of all, the police forces was started, I think, the first modern police force by Robert Peel, and I think the 1840s when he was Home Secretary, possibly earlier. And the point about the police was they were supposed to be citizens in uniform. And both of those is important. They serve the people, of course they do. They're there to prevent crime and to bring to justice those who commit it and to protect the public and so that's their fundamental role. Their role isn't to enforce a political agenda. And I think actually that you can see problems with this, with the fact that they're citizens in uniform. I don't like. And should not be dressed as paramilitaries. I don't like the increasing tendency in Britain, and it comes from elsewhere, and I think I'm afraid to say you definitely see it in Australia too, of over-weaponization of the police. And I like the fact we don't have armed police officers in the UK. I like the fact that they used to wear smartly dressed and not look casual and not look like paramilitaries, which. I'm afraid to say that sometimes you do see, and I think the scruffiness of them that you see is part of that. They should have. I'm not saying we need to go back to the 1950s, and I hope I'm not being seen as that. But I think there is a great benefit in police returning to their principles as being citizens in uniform, as having a limited presence, a real presence. Talk about bobbies in the beat and being visible, and visible policing is a good thing, I think. It's not just about looking at Twitter. It's not just about looking at financial fraud. It's about being present to deter criminals. But it's also about police being approachable, and approachable because they are seen as part of us. The more that they are armed, the more that they wear those enormous batons, which were introduced, I think, mistakenly in the 1980s or 90s in Britain. And the more that they are armed, the more distant they become from the people that they serve. And that's particularly so if they're enforcing a political agenda. They must be above political disputes and controversy. They must be, because otherwise people will lose their attachment to them and will not trust them. I mean, that much is obvious if you look at bad examples of policing in the past, such as perhaps Northern Ireland, although I think things improved hugely there. And there are many other examples that you can think of across the world, but in the English-speaking world as well as the rest of the world. So I think that's a real issue. So who are the police to serve? They're there to serve the public. And then the second point is what people saying about civil disobedience effectively. Well, Jonathan Sumption, a retired Supreme Court judge who was had a valiant 3 years, speaking very early and very loudly against what very, very few other people in authority, if anyone, spoke against back in 2020 when he started this. He said that there is a civic duty to obey the law, but not necessarily a moral duty. And that's obvious because there may be deeply immoral and criminal regimes. You couldn't possibly have a moral obligation to obey those laws. And people must look to their own conscience as to whether or not they consider they have a moral obligation. But they do have a civic obligation in a democratic society. And so, therefore, if they do that, then I suppose they must pay the consequences. And the consequences are on the state, not on them, morally, in those circumstances. I've had long said that all fines imposed on the under the Public Health Act, under these lockdown measures, I think should be revoked. People who paid fines should be repaid, and their criminal records should be wiped. I think we need to, whether or not we need to forgive those who imposed this, what we absolutely must do is say that we made a terrible mistake, and that people who suffered under it and were given criminal penalties under it were subject to a great injustice. And we've seen that. And there are bad examples of this. For example, Trafalgar Square, which is, of course, where most protests end in London, a big protests in London, there were appalling behaviour by police who were using baton charges against protesters who were showing no signs of violence whatsoever. In situations where they had done nothing of the sort, when there was a Black Lives Matter protest, which was equally unlawful, according to the police's interpretation of the rules. And that's yet another example of a politicised police programme that does not allow them to appear above political disputes and on the side of the people and be a neutral force that everyone can rely on and can have trust and confidence in.
It's very interesting. I mean, I think a lot of people, one of the things I did notice is that after the kettling and the attacks that the police made in some of the earlier protests in London in particular and elsewhere, later on, as the protests continued, I spoke to various police that were talking to us, and many more of them seemed to be much more sympathetic. And I think there was a sea change, and as people saw the amount of people coming out and as people started asking more questions, I'm not sure I would agree with you that historically they've always been a neutral force and for the citizens. I think you could point at...
That's fair.
I think you could point at Orgreave and things like that, where you could say that actually sometimes the role of the police has been politicised. But the question would be about who they serve is an important one for us all to think about, and where the public is in all of this. And in a democratic society that's supposed to be based on liberties and freedoms, hard-won freedoms over several centuries. I mean, you mentioned 1689. I mean, if you look at the history of our modern era and the things that we hold to be so fundamental to our way of life, the freedom to congregate and to protest and of conscience and of expression, all those things are paramount. And they got attacked. I mean, it's ironic. And, you know, your point about Boris not having much principle at all, I think is absolutely right, or character. But from someone who's studied the classics and can recite them verbatim, and Cicero and others, and who had said, I would have eaten my own ID card if anyone tells me to do it, to then tell us, we're going to have Freedom Day. This is how Together got created, because on so-called Freedom Day, Boris Johnson says, well, we're going to have Freedom Day now. Well done, everyone. And by the way, we're going to have vaccine passports. It's almost like impossible to imagine how someone who knows as much as he does and has said those things before could actually say that. Yet there we are, right? There we have it. It's kind of a sort of, is it a psychosis? It's a kind of mad moment that happens.
Yeah, that was extraordinary. And again, he looked like he was a hostage when he said that, as he sometimes did on those announcements. I remember one of the very few I watched, because I stopped watching any of those broadcasts after about 2 days of the 16th of March, because they were not good for my mental health, frankly. It made me so angry to watch them lie and cause this appalling disaster. that I stopped watching them because there's absolutely no need to. But anyway, yes, Boris, going back to that, he did look as though he was a hostage. I remember he said, oh, and we'll have to do this. We'll have to do, impose work. It's impossible. That's the other extraordinary thing about this. Every time it's, we have to do this. The only choice is this. As though, first of all, as though the only thing that mattered was the virus, which was an extraordinary and nonsensical position to take. Unless you're faced with an actual plague or a world war, it's very difficult to think of any situation in which you can something one factor can be so ultra predominant over everything else. And this certainly wasn't one of them. All the pandemic plans make that very, very clear that you have to balance all sorts of factors, and everything that you do will have consequences. And in fact, you look back in politics in ordinary times, but any time before 2020, really. And very, very much smaller effects were the cause of huge political controversy. So people say we'll do one thing, but that will cost a huge amount of money. But these are tiny amounts of money and tiny consequences compared to what happened 2020, 2021. And so that's another example. We have to do this, or the only option is this, or the five tests that we had in England and Wales, or England more or less replicated around the UK, which were all to do with the virus and took no account whatsoever. They were introduced in about April 2020, and they prevented us coming out of the lockdown that was supposedly for 3 weeks, because everything was about the virus and nothing was about the consequences, and the metrics and the evidence about the virus were thoroughly disingenuous and misrepresented, in my view, and it's according to a lot of evidence as well.
Absolutely. So on that, I want to just jump in there, yeah, and just say that we're going to go to a quick break, but I want to finish up with you in the last part, Francis, looking at what we might be able to do to make sure we never see this happen again and where we actually are in our landscape. I'm Alan Miller, here with Francis Hoare. This is TNT Radio. Thank you.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Gallup is out with brand new poll results on Americans' attitudes towards the Middle East, and some of the numbers are not good at all. Remember back in October of last year when former President Trump warned American Jews they had better get their act together and realize what they have in Israel before it's too late, noting that evangelical support for the Jewish state outpaced that of Jews in America. For that legitimate concern, Trump was labeled an anti-Semite by the ADL, the White House, and media. Of course he was. The aforementioned groups are made up mostly of Democrats, and Gallup has found that Democrats sympathize more with the Palestinians than the Israelis, 49% to 38%. That's an 11-point increase in Democrat support for the Palestinians in the past year. And to Trump's point, it's worth noting that some 70% of Jews in America lean Democrat. Independents are more sympathetic to Israel, 49 to 32%, but that's up 6 points for the Palestinians. Republicans, they're 80% to 11% in favor of Israel. Overall, the Palestinians register a new high of 31% support, while the 54% of Americans sympathizing more with the Israelis, that's the lowest since 2005. And you can thank the Dems and the biased anti-Israel media for those numbers. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
How often should you wash your hands?
Maybe around 9 times a day.
4? Like 20?
Maybe twice a day.
Whenever they feel dirty.
When should you wash your hands?
After you touch some raw meat.
And before starting to eat.
At the beginning, I wash my hands before preparing food.
How would you rate your knowledge of food safety?
Probably like an 8 out of 10.
6 or 7.
7.5. Like, I know the basics, but I'm not necessarily like an expert in it by any means.
Food safety, it's in your hands.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. Francis, just what I want to do in the last part of the show is consider a couple of things. Firstly, this egregious assault on free speech, as well as all these new laws that are coming out, like the policing bill, the idea that you can be banned from going to any protest. I get that people are very fed up with people sticking themselves to walls and windows, but we've got laws for them already, haven't we? I mean, what's going on? We don't need any more laws, do we? And surely this kind of attempt to constantly legalize every part of our lives rather than just execute the laws that currently exist and allow us, you know, to to live in a free society is very worrying, isn't it?
Yes, and that's a good point. The police have plenty of powers to stop small groups of protesters preventing major arteries, traffic arteries, from functioning. So, for example, trying to stop this happened in the UK a lot last year. It's for some reason, perhaps because of police intelligence, perhaps it is credit to the good policing in that sense. Far fewer of them recently. But a good example of police not using the law and also misapplying the law that actually exists was this suggestion that they had to wait before they removed people who had glued themselves to the road, for example, which they're perfectly entitled to under law to remove them. But there was a case in England called Ziegler, which said that if you were protesting outside an arms fair, it might be that you were not contravening, or it might be that you weren't contravening the law on obstructing the public highway if you were exercising your Article 11 right to protest. But what they didn't say is that the police weren't entitled to remove protesters. What they didn't say is that if you were blocking up a major road, which causes not only causes economic disruption, but potentially risks people's health and even lives because of ambulance access and so on, that they can't remove them. It never said that. And it's a classic example of the police overreaching and misinterpreting the law and not applying it. And also, frankly, applying it in a thoroughly non-neutral way. And I accept what you said, that this isn't a new thing, that you might say that police, it said earlier in the last section, that police sometimes have been partial in the past and they're not always neutral. But the way that they have policed some protests and not policed others in the last 3 years has been a tantalising example of their lack of neutrality, I think. So I don't think the policing bill is necessary, and I think it potentially causes huge problems to free speech. But I think it's one of these classic examples of making political points by legislating rather than actually saying, no, we don't need more legislation. What we need to do is ensure that the police use the powers that they have fairly and don't misinterpret the law and don't fail to act when they could do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've written a lot as well. Thank you. Yeah, on the online safety bill, the concerns around that, and even though the legal but harmful element, which you were really quite rightly thoroughly critical of, has been removed, the terms and conditions that Silicon Valley big tech companies have, the government's kind of outsourced things to them, and in a way, our sovereign free speech is now at the whim of big tech. And we've just seen, haven't we, that an actual presentation by an elected MP in Parliament, by Andrew Bridgen, regardless of what anyone thinks about the content of it, has been taken down from YouTube. And we've seen it all along in the last few months and the last couple of years, where PayPal have deplatformed people that they did not agree with the content of their views of, where Eventbrite have cancelled events where their platform was used to put events on. And you know, this legal free speech is such an important thing, but we're seeing it consistently under attack. And I mean, like, for instance, what's just happened with Andrew Bridgen, we've seen that go on with big tech for a long period of time, as well as, it's not just big tech, of course, because we've seen that the DCMS and other government organizations having encouraged these suffocations. We've seen the Twitter files, and also that there'd even be spy groups on citizens, on journalists and academics and citizens who are criticizing things. This is all stuff of Orwell and 1984, but it's all very real. I mean, what's your thoughts on how we can hold up and defend and protect free speech here in Britain?
Well, I think there are a number of different areas in which free speech is under attack. So one is in academia. That's very important because these are the people who are the future leaders of society whose opinions are being monitored and are being restricted and they are prevented, they sometimes themselves and also academics are preventing the expression of free speech. Another is in employment, and I do employment cases for people who have been sacked for expression of their opinions. We've got one coming up on that. And the other, of course, is in social media. And I did actually suggest a legal way in which we could address this, which is the opposite, of the Online Harms Bill, which is to say that you should not be able legally to remove. If you are a public platform that is open to everyone and not just the members' platforms, i.e. Twitter and YouTube, you should not be able to remove lawful speech that is organic content, unless and when I say lawful, that means unless obviously it's libelous or it causes another tort or it, for example, it commits a criminal offence. So obviously incitement to racial hatred might be one, or incitement to other forms of criminal activity might be another, and so on. And I set up a mechanism. I wrote this report 2 years ago in protection of freedom of speech, and set up this mechanism whereby you would allow, because you need to, when you have a new law, it needs to be done properly and it needs to have fair measures. So it would allow a process by which you investigated if there were reasonable cause to investigate that something was a criminal offence and remove it in that time. But otherwise, you have to put it back in, and you give a defence to social media companies against criminal proceedings if they had a fair process and they found it wasn't either a civil tort or a criminal wrong. And that's the opposite approach to the government's approach and the approach of many governments across the world, which is to enforce censorship on social media companies. So social media companies, as you said, are imposing huge amounts of censorship on public debate. And you're right, absolutely extraordinary to do that to a speech in Parliament, the very place in which you must have the absolute freedom to speak, and parliamentarians are free from civil liability for libel, for example, for anything, or slander would be, I suppose, if anything they say in Parliament. For that reason, they have absolute privilege, because Parliament is the one place, the fulcrum of the nation, where you should be able to debate anything at all with absolute freedom. And that must be reported. And it's all very well to say social media companies are private companies. Well, first of all, they had a very unhealthy relationship with the American state. We know that from the Twitter files that Elon Musk has revealed. And secondly, they are monopolies within their field. And by monopoly, I don't mean that Twitter is the only social media platform for speech, but it has a predominant share of the market for short political posts. YouTube has a predominant share of the market for videos. For example, other ones, of course, Rumble and other ones like that that are better on free speech. But monopoly doesn't just mean you have 100%. It means you have a predominant share in the marketplace. And if you have a predominant share in the marketplace, you have the ability to distort it. And that's not just in prices, but it's also in the ability of people to speak. If you have created what is an amazing resource for the public square, as Twitter is, an ability of anyone, the most ordinary citizen, to influence people and to speak truth to power. But that comes with responsibility, and that responsibility is not to censor. It's not to censor. The obligation is that they should not censor. And they should allow freedom of speech within legal limits, within clear and clearly defined legal limits that we do have. And we obviously do have restrictions on freedom of speech that is criminal or that is libelous and so on, as I said. So we've got it the wrong way around. The social media companies have got it the wrong way around, or had in the past. We see some improvement with Elon Musk on Twitter. I think there is an improvement, but there are still, as you say, there's still huge concerns about the legal threat to of censorship, imposed censorship, in the UK, in Australia, in Canada, in other parts of the world. And of course, the other problem is if content has to be censored in California or in Canada, often that has an effect on other countries. So there is actually a huge problem with international enforcement on a social media company that publishes and broadcasts across the world.
It will be very interesting to see if they're going to do the same thing with the Florida Surgeon General, who's made very robust speech from his point of view, citing The Lancet and all about vaccines.
He's been censored before. He's been censored before, Alan.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if this
Elon Musk came
up. Right, exactly. Well, he has, but we'll see if that's pulled down as well. I suppose in 1 minute, Francis, or less, 45 seconds, tell us your thoughts on the COVID inquiry. And just to say, we'll be hearing more from Francis. We'll definitely want to get you back again. And when we launch the Together Cabinet very soon, we have a whole section on law and policing, and we're very pleased that Francis will be able to be speaking on that too. But tell us your thoughts on this COVID inquiry, please.
Well, the two major points. Firstly, the terms of reference say almost nothing, if not nothing, about the harms of lockdown. They also assume to a very large extent that this is a choice that was necessary. And they fail to look at the pandemic plans. Secondly, almost all the permitted participants are either pro lockdown or from government agencies. And so there's no possibility of a real fair inquiry in that if they have those terms of references and those permitted participants.
Absolutely. Francis Hoare, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio.